This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're all taught to own up to our mistakes, act like an adult, and take responsibility. Harry Truman had a sign on his desk in the Oval Office that read, "The buck stops here." But a lot of us, whether we're in the business or the military, the media, or in politics, have seen an awful lot of buck passing when things go wrong. Sometimes, though often reluctantly, leaders do take the hit. Sometimes a vice president or a cabinet officer falls on his sword. Sometimes we find a scapegoat to carry the onus. This hour, we'll talk with a philosopher, a retired Army colonel, a presidential historian, and a business ethicist to explore who takes responsibility in different circumstances and why. And we want to hear from you. Where do you draw the line between accountability and just passing the buck? And who in your life has acted like a grown-up and who hasn't? If you'd like to join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his office is Howard Kurtz, media reporter for the Washington Post, and the host of CNN's Reliable Sources. Thanks for joining us today, Howard.
Thank you.
Last Monday, you wrote an article about a change in journalism. Top editors resigned following the Jason Blair and Jack Kelly uproars at the New York Times and USA Today, respectively. But that wasn't always the case in years past. What's different?
Well, yeah, there were a whole lot of cases where really bad stuff by reporters was exposed. Janet Cook at my newspaper, Stephen Glass at the New Republic, etc. And the editors in those cases would take responsibility, often would apologize. Same thing happened at the Boston Globe in the late 90s. But hold on to their jobs, if indeed they had enough of a base of support within their news organizations to stay in those jobs. In these last two cases, which were two ethical earthquakes in the news business, you didn't have any apology from either Hal Raines at the New York Times or Karen Jurgensen at USA Today. Both were pushed out of their jobs. They didn't hold news conferences. They didn't answer reporters' questions. They didn't say they were sorry. They just put, you know, one in Jurgensen's case, put out a statement saying she wished they had caught it sooner. Obviously, they do.
But clearly, the people who did wrong at these newspapers were primarily the reporters themselves.
That's the irony here, is that the top editors at these two newspapers were deceived along with other people at the papers and the rest of the public. Nobody is suggesting, they certainly in both cases, there's been persistent and legitimate criticism that they missed a lot of warning signals. In particular, USA Today, there were a lot of warnings about Jack Kelly's reporting. So they can be faulted on those grounds, but why they should have to fall on their sword, to use your earlier phrase, why they should have to resign their jobs because one of their employees screwed up deliberately, intentionally lied, cheated, and deceived them, is a very open question. But I also want to raise the other point, which is, you know, I got the idea for this column after watching one reporter after another demand that President Bush admit his mistakes, that he owed an apology to the American people, and that sort of thing. But the same kinds of questions don't seem to be put to news executives when they preside over what both of these cases was an ethical debacle.
Remind us of the Janet Cook episode. That involved, of course, an editor who was revered in the news business, Benjamin Bradlee of the Washington Post, and perhaps all of the spangles and awards that he got from the Watergate days and other things as well, of course. Maybe that enabled him to ride out the disgrace of having one of his reporters win a Pulitzer Prize for a story that it turned out she'd made up.
This was a horribly embarrassing incident for the Washington Post back in 1981. Janet Cook inventing the story of an 8-year-old heroin addict who we later found out did not exist. But Bradlee did a couple things. He went before a convention of newspaper editors, apologized, and took the fire. He also had his ombudsman write a definitive, you know, many thousand words report on the screw-up, which did not spare management at all. And I think all of that contrasted with, in the case of both Hal Raines and Karen Jurgensen, there was a lot of discontent with their management styles that was rumbling beneath the surface. And so once the dam broke in the form of the Jason Blair and Jack Kelly fabrications, it eventually led to calls for their heads. So I guess the short lesson is, if you're somewhat popular with your newsroom and if you get out in front of the scandal as opposed to letting it overtake you, if you know a little bit about damage control, to use a PR term, then you can survive in these latest two instances that did not happen.
And you suggest that, in fact, in those two cases, unlike in another case, Matt Storn, the editor of the Boston Globe, fired two columnists for irregularities about where their sources were and whether they were, in fact, real or not, said, look, my job here is to fix the problem, not to resign.
Right. And I think a lot of it has to do with not only getting out front by ordering up an investigation, firing people when they need to be fired, and that sort of thing, but in dealing with the inevitable loss of public confidence. Storin, Bradley, Chuck Lane at the New Republic, who had the Stephen Glass fiasco, they all answered reporters' questions. They all made clear that they felt terrible about this. They made themselves available. They took the heat the way we always demand that politicians take the heat. In the case of Hal Raines and Karen Jurgensen, they kind of disappeared. They went in a bunker. They were not available for interviews by and large, and that enabled some of the criticism and the situation itself to kind of spiral out of control. So it's so much easier for media people to demand that politicians do a better job when they preside over something dubious. But at some news organizations, at least, those lessons have not been learned.
Howard Kurtz, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Howard Kurtz is media reporter for The Washington Post, the host of CNN's Reliable Sources, and he joined us from his office at the Washington Post. And again, the question that he raises is, who falls on his sword, when, and why? What in your life has an analogy to that question? Give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Did your boss take responsibility for the fiasco at your office or try to pass responsibility to an underling? Did underlings try to pass responsibility up when it was their fault? Who takes responsibility? 800-989-8255. Of course, this also deals with much else in our normal lives, including our families. Joining us now for the rest of the hour is Joshua Halberstam, a professor at Teachers College at Columbia University, a philosopher and the author of Everyday Ethics, also more recently, Work, Making a Living and Making a Life. He's with us from our bureau in New York, and thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
I wonder your reaction to what Howard Kurtz had to say about USA Today and the New York Times.
I think it's really interesting, and I think one of the things we should think about is the shift that's occurred in these past years that he's been referring to with regard to the way we identify with the jobs that we have, particularly with the institutions that we work for. I mean, one of the phenomena of the recent years is that people no longer say they work for General Motors, for example. They'll say, I'm a software engineer. And what happens with many of these CEOs is that they are about themselves and their careers and less so about the institutions they work for. And so they don't need to fall on that sword anymore because it's not them that it's pointing to. And so that may be one of the things that's going on here.
Now, you think the state nation is a bit confused about taking responsibility, and sometimes that we put blame where you suggest maybe it sometimes doesn't belong.
I think we're deeply confused, and actually for very good reasons. And you've been noticing over the last years an interesting bifurcation of trends in both directions. For example, on the one hand, we have a great deal of medico-babble, psychobabble that holds us responsible for everything that we do, so that even if you have cancer, then it's because you're not living your life properly. If you're shy, it's your fault, and you can correct it, no matter what the situation is. So we tend to make us responsible for everything in our lives. On the other hand, we have this move towards genetic explanations, causal explanations, where everything becomes, as people refer to it, as the excuse abuse, and we're not responsible for anything. And where are we in both those extremes is a difficult question for all of us to figure out.
But again, all of us were raised, at least at some point, our mothers usually try to drill it into our hard little heads, that you have to take responsibility for your personal actions.
We do. And it's interesting, if you take a look at the historical trend here, we're going through a very interesting phase. Consider, for example, 25, 30 years ago, where parents would feel themselves responsible for something like their child's homosexuality, for example, or their child's schizophrenia even 40 years ago. Now we're in a stage where we say, no, you're not responsible. This is genetic. You're not at all to blame for this. In the next generation, we're going to be responsible yet again because we're going to have choices about maneuvering these genes. So this notion that we're responsible in our lives shifts as our biology, knowledge of biology shifts, and as the social world around us shifts. But your question still is up front. You know, what are you responsible for in your life?
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, yeah, no, I was going to say, it's never easy to explain this. And one of the interesting questions that we should ask ourselves is, do you really want to be responsible? Many of us complain about too much responsibility in our lives. And we are responsible for everything that's going on here, our careers in a way that we weren't responsible before. We're responsible for the way we raise our children. And on the other hand, we want this responsibility because it would be terrible to find out that we are, for example, the plaything of some alien species or somebody else's Nintendo game. Responsibility is what makes us live a human life. And so we're always calibrating where we are responsible and where we're not. And we usually get it wrong, I think, because we have all these social institutions that tell us when we're responsible, when in fact we are or aren't. And maybe today we'll figure out what some people have to say about that.
And find out maybe what the rules are. And the rules seem to shift industry to industry sometimes and different walk of life to different walk of life. There are some places where the rules are very clear.
Right. I think that you're hitting on what's really crucial here. Notions of responsibility are determined by expectations. You know, we, for example, it isn't simply causal explanations. I mean, we talk about the rain being responsible for the erosion of a rock, but we're concerned here with moral responsibility, and that depends on what we expect from you. So the sentry is responsible for not falling asleep when the enemy was attacking, but the average soldier who's sleeping is not. So when you have a particular job, we assume certain kinds of responsibilities, but that shifts, as you just pointed out, in industry to industry. Mm. And so our allocations of responsibility will also respond accordingly.
We want to get callers and emailers involved. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN, at npr.org. And let's begin with Dennis, who's with us from Caseville in Utah.
Hello, yes.
Hi, Dennis.
I'm a career soldier. I'm scheduled to get out next year because I'm too old to re-enlist one more time. But I've noticed over my career over the last 34 years rather a shift in leadership's sort of eagerness almost to accept responsibility for things. When I first enlisted in the service in 1965, that was sort of the thing that leadership identifies itself by jumping up and taking responsibility when something goes wrong and getting down to the business of correcting it and controlling damage and things. And through the political world and sometimes even, unfortunately, in really senior military people, there's been a change. There's the old school where people still, leaders especially, sort of jump at accepting responsibility when things go wrong, and then there's others who seem to be covering their tails and turning into politicians when something goes wrong rather than...
I'm assuming you're not using politicians in the positive sense.
Well, having been military all my life, that just sort of evolves eventually.
Is there a difference, Dennis, from the second lieutenant or the captain who's taught, you know, hey, follow me, to maybe the bird colonel or the brigadier general?
It seems that colonels and generals, there seem to be more of them in politics these days. That a good politician who wants to remain a politician has to do what a politician has to do. And that sort of puts him in the other category besides someone who is just pursuing what he believes in. And if it drags him down, then at least he goes down, you know, doing what he believes in, as opposed to someone whose primary job is to survive for the next election.
Josh, we just have a few seconds left in this segment, but you'd think the military would be one of those walks of life where things are particularly clear.
You know, one of the horrid phrases of the 20th century was, I was just following orders. And yet you can't run a military unless people follow orders. And at what point does the buck stop in the military is another one of those shifting bucks, right? And we've had some bad situations just last week where we got some news about out of Iraq about American soldiers engaging in activities. And who's going to take the fall for that one is going to be a really interesting situation to see.
And Dennis, I'm sure we're all going to be watching that pretty closely. That's indeed is going to be an interesting answer.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for the call, Dennis. And
okay.
34 years, thank you.
Yeah,
my
it's
pleasure.
A long time.
Yep.
The country's worth it.
Okay.
We'll be back with more after a break. We're talking about responsibility. We want to hear your stories. Tell us about a time you decided to take responsibility regarding a difficult situation, or maybe you didn't. 800-989-8255. Email TOTN at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what it means to own up to a problem, to take responsibility at work and in one's personal life. Our guest is Joshua Halberstam, the author of Everyday Ethics. If you'd like to join the conversation, if you've ever been at the receiving end of the proverbial buck, give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. And let's talk with John, and he's on the line with us from Des Moines, Iowa.
Yes.
Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I was when I was young, another employee and I went out and got drunk and came to work inebriated, and we got reported to our boss, and the boss confronted us the next day. And unfortunately, at that time, I tried to make excuses, and my fellow employee stepped up to the plate and said, yeah, we did it, and we screwed up. And it taught me a great lesson about how I embarrassed myself by, first, by my actions of getting drunk, and secondly, by trying to deny it or justify it. And it's been a good lesson to serve me on to see how to handle it appropriately as far as just stepping up and taking what you have coming to you and moving on, because that's how I regained the trust of my boss later on, was by always being accountable for what I did.
I hope you weren't a brain surgeon at the time, John.
No, I wasn't.
You know, but John raises a very important point about the way we apologize. Usually, if you listen to people apologize, they're always saying things like, I'm sorry, but let me explain to you why I did what I did, and they end up trying to excuse themselves, which is, of course, ends up completely destroying the whole point of the apology, because if you excuse somebody, then they don't need an apology. But let me just say a little bit something about the way this apology works and why it's interesting the way these news people did not apologize. When you apologize in our culture, one of the things you say is, I beg your forgiveness. And the reason why you beg is because when you did something wrong to somebody, you created a disequilibrium. You messed around with the other guy. So now what you got to do is restore that balance by saying, I'm sorry. You got to lower yourself to do that. And when we just heard the caller say that he tried to deflect his own apology until he realized, no, I really did something wrong, and I'm going to have to beg forgiveness. Hmm. We have to learn how to do that a little bit better, I think.
And, John, we're going to be talking about politics later, but the lesson there is, as in all of life, is it's not so much the original crime, it's always the cover-up.
That's right. We've learned that.
John, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Prakash Sethi, a business professor at the Zicklin School of Business at Baruch College. He teaches international business and corporate responsibility. So thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I know you've been listening to the program. We started out with how two top editors at big newspapers reacted to problems in their ranks. Do media executives react differently from CEOs at other kinds of companies?
Well, probably not. Most CEOs, people don't realize it, they are a culture and a tribe unto themselves. The best example I could think of is that they are like the divine king. They could do no wrong. They have so insulated themselves through the control of their boards and through heightened public expectations but lack of control that they literally don't take any responsibility for anything that goes wrong, and yet they take full credit and probably multiple of that credit in terms of compensation for making the corporation make progress or succeed.
Is that why you think we heard not a single CEO at Enron or Tyco or one of those say, you know, hey, I'm sorry I let everyone down, as opposed to saying, you know, hey, I'm sorry all those other people let you down?
Well, we should make a slight distinction in terms of there are three types of things that in a company as large as most of these are that could happen. One is that the company is very well managed, but there's a rogue employee, and he does something wrong. The example closer to would be a journalist and an editor. Mm-hmm. But since the CEO cannot possibly manage 200,000 or 300,000 employees and maybe at least 5,000 managers all over the world, it's unrealistic for us to ask that person to either resign or even punish or even take blame for it, because that is a rogue employee exception to the rule. The second thing is, if the person has put together systems and procedures to manage the company and there's a systemic violation of those procedures, he has been an inefficient or ineffective manager, then he must be held responsible for it. They do not do that. And the third and the last thing is, of course, where they are personally involved in the wrongdoing and gain from it. Maybe one or two of these guys would go to jail. We go through that every 10 years. Before that, it was Mike Milliken and Bosky, and before that, it was ITT and others. But the larger problem always remains because the system of corporate structure is such that other CEOs feel that he is going to be punished, not because he did something wrong, because they all behave the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But he got caught. And if you see it, have you ever heard a single word from any other CEO saying corporations or CEOs like this do not belong in the leadership cadre of the major corporations? You don't hear a single word about them because they do not feel that these guys have done anything different except they exceeded the line.
Let's get another caller involved, and joining us now is Michael. He's on the line with us. Go ahead, Michael.
How do you do? I'm a Mythos consultant for the past 20 years. One of the things I find fascinating today is that they have to legislate possibility with something like Sarbanes-Oxley.
Michael, let's give it one more try. We're having problems with your cell phone.
Oh, okay. I was saying that what I find amazing is today they have to legislate responsibility through Sarbanes-Oxley,
mm-hmm.
where years ago you did have CEOs who took responsibility.
Give me a for instance.
Well, I did deal several years ago with one of the Fortune 500 who, when they made a mistake, their CEO was the first to step forward and say, "We made a mistake. I am the one who approved it. Therefore, I'm responsible. The buck stops here." Today, you will not find a CEO who does that.
Prakash Sethi was just telling us. Thanks, Michael, for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, if I can just interject here with a question here to Prakash, is one of the problems going on in this whole system is the identification of responsibility with legality, with legal responsibility. So you have all these CEOs who say, listen, I'm not responsible because I haven't been caught violating any legal situation, but their responsibility may be very different in terms of their business abilities or what they did in terms of the corporate culture and a whole slew of other things. But there seems to be an attitude that says, listen, if I didn't violate the law, then you can't hold me responsible, period.
Well, the question of violating the law is after the fact, not before the fact. And in the sense, it's obvious that things did not work. The corporation suffered. It's obvious that the performance suffered. Things are going wrong, whether or not they are legal. As you said, the buck stops here. He or she should be responsible. Now, there's a big difference in Japan. The top CEO or the top person in a company, the moment anything goes wrong, serious, which has public consequences, would invariably step forward, apologize to the nation because it caused the nation and this people harm, and resign from the job. And he is considered honorable for doing the honest or the honorable thing. No, the other part of it is that he is not punished for doing that. He's revered. In the U.S., the problem is also the legal part. The moment a CEO accepts responsibility as an officer of the company, that means that he is accepting the responsibility on behalf of the company also. Suddenly, you would see 2 million class action suits, and all the shareholders would lose their money, and the company would go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
So the CEO is forced by the corporate counsel and the lawyers not to make that admission because the personal responsibility immediately transcends to the institutional responsibility. So unfortunately, even if a CEO wanted to take responsibility, he wouldn't be allowed to do so.
Mike,
not that they are jumping up and down to do that.
Yeah, Mike gets sued for every single cord in his golden parachute.
Precisely.
Prakash Sethi, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Prakash Sethi, a professor of business at the Zicklin School of Business at Baruch College, where he teaches international business and corporate responsibility. Well, assuming blame in politics is a double-edged sword, politicians are not advised to apologize often. Joining us now is Robert Dalek, a presidential historian, has written biographies of FDR, Lyndon Johnson, and John F. Kennedy. He's working on a new book about Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, and he joins us from inside the National Archives. Always good to speak with you, Robert.
Yes, nice to be with you.
We talked about Harry Truman at the top of the hour with his "The Buck Stops Here" sign on his desk. What kind of signal did that send to the American people?
Well, I think they like it when a president, so to speak, steps up to the plate and says, I'm the responsible party, I'm the chief executive, and I'm not going to cast aspersions on or put blame on others for the mistakes that have been made by the government. But, you know, of course, it's rare that a president does that. When there is success, they trumpet it. And when there's failure, the impulse is to blame it on their predecessor or somebody else, or even to deny that there's failure. Of course, the one great exception that everyone remembers was John Kennedy after the failure at the Bay of Pigs, and he stepped forward and said, I'm the responsible party, the chief executive who made this decision, and I take responsibility. But that's really more the exception than the rule.
Well, let's talk for a minute about President Nixon, and I guess everybody remembers these famous words.
People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Before Richard Nixon resigned, just about every single member of his administration, his inside cabinet, his chief of staff, they all resigned first.
Yes, they did indeed. And he shunned responsibility and avoided the bobbed and weaved until, of course, they had the smoking gun from the tapes he had made. And as they say, he was hoisted on his own petard. Gosh, reading the papers of Nixon is just quite amazing. He has something called annotated news summaries, and every day news stories annotated by him. And he was just livid about any criticism the press would put forward, anything they'd be blaming him for. And he would work on trying to avoid blame. And but, you know, they're so preoccupied, presidents, with being reelected. And even in the second term, they become intensely concerned about their historical reputation. And so almost everything seems to be aimed in the direction of trumpeting their victories.
Well, isn't it, particularly when you're talking about a head of state, and not just in this country, but in others around the world, there's an impulse to protect the prince, the king, the president. Someone else will fall on their sword and let the leader go on.
Yeah, that's quite true. And I guess it's partly the sense of you'll bring in stability to the government. But, of course, we have parliamentary systems, as you do in Britain and in Israel. Prime ministers fall when there are failings and they lose control of their majority, and the blame is laid at their doorstep, however much they may deny it, and their governments collapse. So there are systems of government that build in a kind of responsibility and punish those who fail at their appointed tasks.
In retrospect, from an historian's vantage point, are you surprised that Richard Nixon is the only American president who was resigned?
Well, I am, but I think what it speaks to is the fact that we do have we value greatly the institution of the presidency and the stability that we like to attach to it. And if we had presidents resigning every day or being impeached every day, it would, I think, drive us kind of mad. And what's striking, of course, is Bill Clinton was the only elected president ever to have been impeached. Of course, the only other president to have been impeached was Lincoln's successor, and he hadn't been elected to the White House.
Andrew Johnson, of course.
Yes. Yeah.
Robert Dalek, we'll let you get back to your research.
Thank you very much.
Robert Dalek is a presidential historian. He's written biographies of FDR, Lyndon Johnson, and John F. Kennedy. He's working on a new book about Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. He was with us today from a payphone inside the National Archives. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Joshua Halberstam is still with us. And I wanted to read an email we got from Stephen in Charlotte, North Carolina. To me, he writes, a lack of responsibility is a lack of integrity. I find it disturbing how this quality is lacking in my generation. And he says 18 to 35, but I suspect that's not isolated to his generation, but go ahead.
No, I suspect that people have been saying that for forever. People think that their generation is worse than anybody else's. I mean, I don't know that individually we're just the worst generation, 18 to 35-year-olds are. But But it is true that that collectively, as a nation, we don't talk that much about responsibility in terms of our relationships to other people. We spend a lot more time talking about responsibility to ourselves. You know, we'll get self-help programs, for example, where we feel like we're not responsible to what we to our own selves and our own goals. And that, I think, is a bit disturbing.
Let's talk now with Reuben. And Reuben joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
My question is there a difference between the extent to which people take responsibility based on their culture? Do different cultures have different approaches as far as publicly taking responsibilities?
Oh, I think for sure that's the case. For example, we heard a little bit about Japan earlier, which is what one of these cultures that we call shame cultures, where people, by taking responsibility, shame themselves, and that's the punishment in themselves. And other cultures don't have such mandates to take responsibility. So I think it does shift from responsibility, does shift from culture to culture. Although being a universalist about these sort of issues, I think there is some sense that every individual is responsible for their lives no matter where they live. And these things are absolutist in a sense. They're not dependent on where you live.
But as Prakash Sethi said about Japanese industrialists, surely there are cultural expectations of how they're supposed to behave that are rather different from what their expectations might be in either Germany or Ohio.
Clearly. I mean, when we're talking about institutions, whether it be government or the military or corporations, those things are social constructs in that sense. And, of course, the responsibility will depend on what we attribute to them, right, and what we give them from the outset. Whether individuals are responsible differently becomes a more interesting question. And, in fact, as a collective, as we go forward and have to figure out our own future genetic structures, we as a nation and as a community are going to have a real heavy-duty responsibility on our laps to figure out what kind of human beings we want in the future. And that's going to be interesting.
Reuben, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And let's try to squeeze in a call before the break. Douglas is with us from Rupert, Idaho.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
My wife and I have just had our son, who's 4 going on 5, lifted some toys from a coffee shop that we frequent. And we, of course, made him go back and apologize and return the things and fess up to the owner of this coffee shop. But what we were surprised about was how some of our friends and family thought that that was too young to instill responsibility in a child and that we should have just either not returned the toys or returned them ourselves and not had him face up to the music.
Joshua Halberstam?
That's an interesting case. I actually went through a change on that. I used to, when my son used to beat up on his sister, and I would say, well, go say you're sorry. And he'd say, but I'm not sorry. And for a long time, I thought that was a good argument. If you're not sorry, there's no point in saying I'm sorry. I now come to realize that there's a point in learning how to say I'm sorry, even if you don't think that you want to say you're sorry, simply because, as I said earlier, because you've got to go through these behavioral motions, and they're important. And I think it's a very good lesson to make kids apologize. So I think you did the right thing, Rupert.
Thanks
for the call. When we come back from a short break, more on taking responsibility. We'll be joined by a retired colonel from the United States Army. I'm Neil Conan. By the way, if you'd like to join the conversation, it's 800-989-8255, or you can email us, TOTN@npr.org. I'm still Neil Conan, and it's still Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about where you draw the line between accountability and passing the buck. By the way, we got a note from our political editor, Ken Rudin, about a comment that was made by historian Robert Dalek earlier in the program. And he said John F. Kennedy took responsibility for the Bay of Pigs fiasco. And Ken Rudin noted that, yes, President Kennedy did take the blame for that, but for decades afterwards, his aides blamed President Eisenhower for that. Our guest is Joshua Halberstam, the author of Everyday Ethics and a professor at Columbia University. Of course, we want to hear from you. Was there a time in your life you decided to accept responsibility and it altered your life? Our number is 800-989-8255, or you can email us, TOTN@npr.org. And also joining the conversation now is Colonel Robert Killebrew, retired from the U.S. Army. He joins us from his home in Newport News, Virginia. Nice to talk to you again, Colonel.
Nice to talk to you, Neil. What's up?
I know you've been listening from the start of the program. We've talked about how the media and big corporations and politicians all deal with accountability. How does the military measure up by comparison?
Well, the military's got a different system, as you know, and has been mentioned. I have to mention just in passing that the term falling on your sword is a military term from the ultimate responsibility for winning a battle.
or losing one in this case.
Or losing one, that's right.
Yeah. Now, we've seen the situation coming out in the past few days about the U.S. soldiers reprimanded, some charged with court-martial offenses in the alleged abuse of Iraqi prisoners. And the U.S. officer who oversaw Baghdad's Abu Ghraib prison suggested Monday that more may be involved, higher-ups. We saw a comment today from Anthony Cordesman, the famous military expert, who said anything short of a court-martial of general officers will be seen throughout the region as a cover-up. How is this going to play out, do you think, in terms of military culture?
Well, there are three ways to look at responsibility in terms of military culture. Every soldier, by regulation, is responsible for certain things having to do with the execution of his or her duty. A private going to sleep on guard, for example, is responsible for his duty. There is command responsibility, which is a far more severe and encompassing responsibility that goes to the principle of a military unit or a military duty being responsible to a single commander. And command responsibility can be passed or failed even if the commander is not present on the scene, on the principle that he's responsible for anything his or her unit does or doesn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a kind of a culture of responsibility, too. And that culture of responsibility increases the longer you're in and becomes more ingrained in the organizations and the thing you do the longer you're in the service and the higher up you go in rank structure. In the case of this lamentable, horrible situation with the POW camps, what we're seeing are the results of initial investigations, and you're seeing lower-ranking soldiers probably being found guilty. I say probably because I haven't seen the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Probably being found guilty of a failure of personal responsibility. Every American soldier is taught how to treat POWs, and that is not what we teach.
These are detainees, a minor difference that we understand. The Geneva Convention is very similar to
that's it's relevant for this conversation, though.
Right.
When an enemy combatant is under the care of American guards are taught, every soldier is taught, that there are ways you do and don't treat POWs, and mm-hmm. that is an egregious error just on the face of it.
And ultimately, would you expect somebody of the general, a flag rank officer, to have to take the blame for this?
Oh, absolutely. I can tell you now in my conversations with other retirees over the last several days, we're all shaking our heads and saying this, on the face of it, is an egregious failure of command responsibility somewhere.
On the level with perhaps even more than the famous example of the naval captain, if his ship runs aground even while he's asleep, it's still his fault.
That's absolutely right, and that's the only way a military service can work. If you vest immense responsibility in a single individual, that individual has to be held responsible. And you may remember the sad case of the Marine barracks blowing up in Beirut back in the 80s.
Sure.
President Reagan stepped forward and took responsibility, as he might have, as well he did. But within the military service, and within the Marines in particular, there was a strong feeling that, no, we should have been allowed to settle the question of ultimate command responsibility. And that has been true in every case of military failure that I can think of.
Colonel Killebrew, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Colonel Robert Killebrew, retired from the U.S. Army, joined us from his home in Newport News, Virginia. And Joshua Halberstam is still with us. Let's see if we can get some more calls in. And Colleen joins us from San Francisco.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm afraid my phone line is not...
That sounds fine. Go ahead, Colleen.
I think that it's interesting what what the previous caller just mentioned about the accountability to a single commander, and secondly, the culture of responsibility. I think that that's something that our modern culture, not exclusive of our country, is really suffering from, and that is a higher principle. possibly you might think of it as, for instance, Pharaoh and Joseph. Joseph was capable of being loyal to Pharaoh and having integrity because he had higher principles that he adhered to. And I think that in our relativistic culture, where there is no absolute like Pilate said, truth, what is truth? People are sort of ineffective, amputated. You know, their functioning, their principles, their virtues are sort of functioning like amputated limbs. They're not connected to an integrated whole.
So and situational ethics is what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah. And so people feel fragmented, and they are they're living their, you know, that idea of accountability, the pain that is the result of accountability when the onus is on us, mm-hmm. is something that, like Nietzsche said, and I'm loosely paraphrasing, he said, a person can bear with any how if he knows why.
I'm not sure you're up on a level with Nietzsche, Joshua Halberstam, but maybe we get a response.
Well, I think what the caller is pointing out to is when you think about personal responsibility, the question is who you're responsible to, and you can get lots of different answers here. One is to others, one is to God, one is to yourself, and you'll probably get very different answers as a result. The one thing that I would also point out is that when we talk about responsibility, because of the way the language is set up, we're talking about blame a lot more than we're talking about credit. But, of course, responsibility also refers to credit. And one of the things that I find lacking, personally, in the culture is more talk about the credit responsibility as opposed to the blame. For example, the heroes who run in and save people at the Twin Towers, they are responsible for saving lives, and I want to know what was going on in their minds. And more talk about that kind of responsibility would help. In fact, if I can just give an example, I think we're all a little bit confused about it. I mean, it's confused in the sense that we're not clear about this in our own lives. For example, if you ask people, would you rather be told that you're smart because you were born smart or because you worked hard as a student? Would you rather be told you're good-looking naturally or a natural athlete or that you're responsible for your looks because of operations you had or you worked hard? And you'll get very conflicting answers within oneself, which tells us that we're not really sure what we're responsible for in our own lives and what even we want to get credit for. And that gets a sort of an interesting sort of repercussions in this area.
Colleen, thanks very much. Interesting question.
Thank you very much.
We're talking with Joshua Halberstam, a professor at Teachers College, the author, among other books, of Everyday Ethics. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line. Anna is with us from Westlake, Ohio.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What my comment really ties into the whole issue of responsibility versus blame.
Mm-hmm.
I live with two chronic health problems that are painful and scary. It's endometriosis and rupturing ovarian cysts, and they're not going to kill me, but they're kind of harrowing to live with. And people have said some interesting things to me. One person said, and this is somebody I was getting a massage from at the time, maybe you should think about why you've invited this illness into your life. And I haven't been back to her since. She's a nice lady. And the other thing people have said to me were, of course you're not going to have children, because if you do, they could have this too, and you would be responsible for their suffering in that way. And it's made me really think about, well, is it my fault that I have these because I invited them into my life by through some mechanism, or is it somebody else's fault because that I have them because I was exposed to some sort of environmental toxin? And, well, you know, it's somebody else's fault, but ultimately it's my responsibility for being able to get by day to day.
And Josh Halberstam, is it the massage therapist's fault that she now has a blank spot on her schedule every day?
Yeah, right. She deserves that one. She's responsible for it. But I'm curious to know, how do you answer the second question about the children? I mean, if let's say, not in your case, somebody is carrying a genetic defect, you think it would be wrong to have a child in that case? How do you answer that question?
With me, I realized I have a lot of opinions about that. And not having children, I feel kind of, I know that I have this giddy belief that I know what's best for other people. And it's easy for me to judge because I don't have children of my own yet. And I really hope that I'll be able to have children. But I know that if I can't, then my fiancé and I have said that we'll adopt. But I have a lot of opinions. I noticed if somebody I know had lupus and she took a lot of medication to suppress her immune system so that she would be able to have a pregnancy in which she knew that their child would have a lot of health problems, and he does. And, you know, I think of things like Huntington's, and I think that's brutal. But, you know, on our genes, on our side, we might have Parkinson's, we might have Alzheimer's, we're definitely going to be mopey, and we should definitely stay away from the Bud Light. But other than that, I feel like, you know, being able to reproduce should be a right, But I do get scared sometimes thinking, if my daughter suffers with what I have, is it my fault?
You're responsible. Right?
Yeah. Anna, thank you. It's a very thoughtful. I just hope everybody who's in your situation, and we hope you work it out, but that everybody's as thoughtful as you are about it.
Well, that's nice of you to say so. Thank you.
Appreciate the phone call.
Get a new masseuse, yeah.
Get a new masseuse. Let's go to John, and John joins us from New London, Connecticut.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
Love the show.
Thank you.
I'm a teacher, and as you all know, that the teachers bear the ultimate responsibility for the buck. You know, when student test scores are low, it's the teacher's fault. When a kid can't read, it's the teacher's fault. When he can't do basic math, it's the teacher's fault. No Child Left Behind puts an incredible onus on me as a teacher. And I'd just like to know, where's the community in all of this? Where are the parents? Where's the, you know, the business community? Where are the politicians involved in this dilemma? How much responsibility do I have to take for other people's children?
And, John, to reverse that coin, and based on what we were hearing earlier from Joshua Halberstam, aren't teachers responsible every time somebody is a success as well? When somebody scores well on the test, gets into a good college, goes on to become, a public servant or do something good for the community?
Oh, and absolutely. And I'm more than happy to take responsibility. I'm very proud of many of my students who have been very successful. I constantly put them on display, and I think that as teachers, I think we do need to do that more. We do need to elevate our successful students and to bring them to the forefront. And it's just, but the thing is, those kids slip into the cracks.
Yeah. Josh, I guess John, in a way, is right. Teachers and mothers take an awful lot of hits.
Oh, I mean, this is one area. I mean, I work at a teacher's college, and the unfairness of how everybody just dumps everything on teachers when it's clearly our social issues as the fall guy. I mean, talk about jumping on the sword over here. I mean, they just get stabbed every single day by swords. And I think that that's a really important point. On the other hand, one of the problems is that when you start talking about collective responsibilities of that sort, so that the whole society is responsible for every child, it gets too amorphous. So what do you do with that information? It's just too hard. So we have to start isolating and say, well, you're responsible for X and you're responsible for Y. But just to say that we're all responsible for everything is almost a tautology, and it doesn't get us very far. So we're really caught between this rock and a hard place here.
So, John, you teach at Scapegoat High School there in New Haven?
I teach at New London High School, home of the Whalers, and outstanding school with many wonderful, wonderful children. But we don't get the credit we deserve.
Well, I have some experience with New London. It's a good town, and thanks very much for everything you do there. Appreciate it, John.
Thank you for the call, sir.
And Joshua Halberstam, thank you for your time today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks,
Josh Halberstam, professor at Teachers College at Columbia University, also a philosopher and the author of Everyday Ethics, more recently Work, Making a Living and Making a Life, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.